This is the RightsCast Network at RightsCast.net.
Hey there, and welcome to episode 5 of Novel Approaches here on the RightsCast Network. I'm RightsCast Network founder and Novel Approaches co-host, R.R. Campbell. In this episode, co-hosts Yon Ashleman and I were joined by guests Danielle Maurer and Chris Bedell, with whom we discussed and compared various world-building strategies for both the pre-write stage and the actual drafting of a manuscript itself. Before we get into the episode, let's get to better know those guests. Chris Bedell has been published in Thought Catalog, Entropy Magazine, and Foliate Oak Literary. He graduated with a BA in creative writing from Fairleigh Dickinson University, and his YA fantasy, In the Name of Magic, is to be released by Nine Star Press in August of 2018. Then, of course, there's Danielle Maurer, who listeners to the R.R. Campbell RightsCast might recognize from episodes 11 and 20 of that other show on the RightsCast Network. Danielle is a fantasy and science fiction author who's on an epic quest to entertain her readers. In addition to writing her own fiction, she regularly reviews science fiction and fantasy novels on her blog at daniellemaurer.com. She also reviews short fiction at SFF Reviews. I was really glad Danielle agreed to return to the RightsCast Network for this episode and also to have Chris join us for his first visit to one of our shows. All right, let's get right into this conversation on worldbuilding featuring Yon Ashleman, Danielle Maurer, Chris Bedell, and yours truly, R.R. Campbell. Stay tuned after the episode for advance notice of what we'll be covering in the next Novel Approaches episode, and thanks, as always, for listening. Well, welcome, listeners, to this Novel Approaches episode. We're talking world building today, and we are joined by guests that I'm really glad we're able to make this time available to talk about this interesting topic. We are joined, of course, for our mainstay, that is Yon Ashleman. Thank you, Yon, for joining me.
Thanks for having me back. Much excite.
Yay! And we have another return guest, and that is Danielle Maurer. Danielle, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Always happy to be here, especially for topics that I'm passionate about, like world building.
Yay, world building. And then last, but certainly not least, we have a new guest on this Novel Approaches, and that is Chris Bedell. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about world building.
Yeah, this is going to be a really exciting episode, I think. And one of the things that I think is really important to kind of pin down as we advance through the conversation is talking about, you know, where world building begins. So, Chris, you're new to the show. Why don't we start with you? Let's talk a little bit about, in your view, where does world building begin?
I guess it begins with trying to see how your novel or story is unique and then mining those details. For example, is there a ritual in your world different? Like in my book, In the Name of Magic, there's not sports, but there's magical dueling, and I use that in a chapter, but I just don't have that as an outing. That's also an opportunity to explore the character conflicts and mine that as well. So my writing is doing more than one thing at the same time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it does. It seems kind of like the way that you're posing it, and don't let me put words in your mouth if this isn't the case, but it seems like perhaps you view it as sort of a gateway into things like character and plot.
Yes, exactly. That's 100% how I view it.
Well, then let's turn it over to you, Danielle, and get your opinion on this. You know, when you are writing, where does world building begin for you?
So I typically write a lot of secondary world fantasy, stuff like Tolkien, where the entire universe has to be created. So I like to start with a map. I actually like to sit down with pen and paper, kind of sketch out an idea of what the world looks like, and then I step forward from there. I think about how that geography is going to impact the cultures of the people who will live there. So, you know, in my most recent book, I did a great river civilization that was surrounded by a desert, sort of inspired by Egypt a little bit. And I really had to think then about how that setting would impact the traditions and the language and just the whole thought process of the people who would live in that setting. So that's where I like to start.
That's really interesting that you mentioned that. That kind of reminds me of something that came up when I was in school, and it was, and I hope I'm remembering this correctly, but Jared Diamond, I believe, was the author, talking about nonfiction, you know, if we want to dip into that realm, and talking about how culture and civilization in general is shaped so much by the land. And so it only makes sense to take a similar approach,
you know, kind of what you're saying there. You start with the map and see how the landscape affects people and how they coexist with that landscape and what that means for them as a civilization.
Absolutely. That's actually a great book. I think you're talking about Jared Diamond's, well, Collapse is one of them.
Yeah, and I think it's Guns, Germs, and Steel was the other one I was thinking of. Yeah, for sure. Well, those are interesting to check out if you want to use a nonfiction approach to back up world building, I suppose. But let's hop over to you then, Sion. Where do you see world building beginning?
Mine begins with the characters, and I mentioned on a different episode that I don't like to do too much pre-work. I think of it as efficient, but I think you could just as easily call it lazy. But I think about the characters. I think about things like, what do they see? What do they hear, smell, taste, touch? What do they wear? What laws and customs affect how they behave and the consequences of their actions? What sources of conflict or danger could arise from their environment, like animals or extreme weather or particular laws and customs that they might come into conflict with? What would they do to meet their survival needs, like food, water, shelter, things like that? Would they hunt and gather? Would they steal it? Would they work for it? What kind of job would they have? What kind of food do they eat? What do they do in their spare time? You know, those leisure activities. What do you do for fun? How does religion influence their worldview? And one that I like to think about that often doesn't make it into my books is, how do they go to the bathroom?
That's interesting.
I'm working on a historical pirate romance and really got hung up on this question, because like, where and how do you go to the bathroom on a ship? And so I had a lot of fun researching that one.
That's very interesting. And I noticed Danielle flagged me down. She had a point to add here. So Danielle, what did you want to add?
It's really just building on what Sion just said, but I think the best place to start with world building in more just general terms is being curious and asking those questions. The more questions you can ask and answer for yourself, the better prepared you're going to be down the line, because you never know what's going to come up in the process of writing. So the more you have that knowledge in your head, the easier it's going to be.
I think that's a really good point to bring up. And Sion, you know, as you were kind of listing some of the things that you like to think of, that to me is a really good transition into the second question that we have for this conversation, which is, you know, what we consider to be part of world building. You know, what is that more granular stuff that we're taking a look at? The things that, I guess, as Danielle is putting it, that we want to make sure we're curious about as we go about planning for this world that we're creating. And so let's turn back then to Chris. What thoughts might you have on, you know, what is part of world building? What are those little, what are the boxes that you like to check, for example, when you're creating worlds for yourself?
But some things I like to consider are customs, traditions, or even geography or anything about a city. But I want to have it in an organic way. I just don't want to have information dumping. I want it to be relevant to the scene level conflict in some way, so it's not just like reading an encyclopedia.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and I'm glad that you mentioned that. Sion, I could see you kind of nodding along, if I'm not mistaken, that that seemed to catch your attention, right?
Yeah, 100%. I think that's really important for me, too, is like knowing that the questions that I'm exploring are relevant to what I'm actually writing.
And I would say, and maybe Danielle, since I get the impression, since you like to start with something like a map, maybe this kind of plays into what your approach might be, where, you know, Chris says, we don't want to get in a position where we're just info dumping, but if I had to guess, your approach might be, well, let's create all that info so we know it's available to pick from. Does that seem about right?
Yeah, so I always call this the bleeding through the cracks effect, right? You don't want to go on a long info dump. That's just going to end up being really cumbersome. But I like having all that data at my disposal so that when I am in need of a tradition, or I have a situation where I'm thinking, well, how would this society handle that problem? I have some of that data and I can go look at it. Because I'm a bottom-up builder, that means that I end up with a ton of stuff I'm never ever going to use. But I'm okay with that. I mean, for me, my worlds are not a one-book investment. They are a multiple-book investment. And so something that doesn't get used in one book might get used in a different book later. So then I'm consistent.
Yeah, and I think that consistency is something we'll definitely be speaking about a little bit later in this conversation, but I am glad you mentioned it. And I'm also glad that you mentioned, you know, creating worlds with the intention of writing for a series, because it's something that I think we can surprise ourselves. You know, we might think we only have one book in us, but if we can create a world where, again, we want to have ourselves be curious about all these different facets, you know, all these different things that are going on in it, we can kind of stumble our way into a series, for example, which is kind of, and I'm going to take a second to toot my own horn because it's exciting news, but as we're recording this, I did just go public with my announcement that Empathy will be getting published in January 2019 by Nine Star Press. Yay! And that is anticipated to be a series, fingers crossed, that they do like the second through possibly fifth books. So it's really fun to be outlining all of that right now. I'm going really hard with outlining the second book and starting the third, and it's exciting, but I wouldn't be able to do it this quickly if I didn't know things like the political backdrop of the world or, you know, what it is that everyone's after on these deeper levels. There's so many characters, and I'm going to talk mostly about the politics in this exact moment because book two gets a little political, but all these characters that were always there but they don't actually show up in the first book, they were still lurking the whole time. So when we create these vast worlds for ourselves, we open ourselves up to that series potential, and I think that's a really good point that you've made there, Danielle. And Sion, I know you gave us a little bit of a list of the things that you consider to be part of world building. Do you have anything that you'd like to add to that list you sort of gave as part of the response to question one?
I mean, it's really just anything that helps me answer those questions and then the sub questions under those questions. But I have some ideas here about arts, entertainment, sports, which Chris mentioned earlier, religion, food, flora and fauna, economy, customs, laws, weapons, weather, government, music, architecture.
The list goes on. Yeah.
Really, it goes on. Like, anything.
But, yeah, definitely. And Danielle, I see you've flagged me down. You've got a point here. What is it you'd like to add?
Just to add to Sion's list, but another one not to forget is language as well.
Yeah, that's a really
good
point.
You don't necessarily have to go the full route and do, you know, a conlang like some people do, but even just thinking about swear words are a personal favorite of mine. You know, what we use to swear probably isn't what someone in Fantasyland is going to use to swear by. That sort of thing.
Yeah, and that's actually, this is all a really nice transition into where I wanted to take this conversation next, which was talking about aspects of world building that might generally be overlooked. I think swearing is definitely one of them. Let's hop over to Chris and see, Chris, do you have anything that you often feel is commonly overlooked when one is creating worlds for themselves as they write?
I feel like something that's overlooked, this is more of a general comment, but it still applies. I feel like people think world building has to be this complicated thing, but it really doesn't. Like I was saying earlier in the podcast, it can be anything that adds to the novel or story, and it should also be doing multiple things at the same time because a writer has so much ground to cover in so little time and wants maximum dramatic effect.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Again, we're talking about that sort of like, you know, Danielle, you had a quote, and I think I wrote this down, was it's what bleeds through the cracks, you know? We want to get the world to kind of bleed through the cracks so that it feeds characters, so the character feeds plot, and it all kind of comes back in on itself in a sort of positive feedback loop. And I think that's a really good approach to have, and it's refreshing to hear it being doubled down on because it is something that I think is so critical in the presentation of one's world and the manuscript as a whole. Let's go to Sion then too. Is there anything that you feel often gets overlooked in world building, or some little niche things that we might not be thinking about at the top of our head when we're creating worlds for ourselves?
How they go to the bathroom.
That's the one. That's the one. It's always about that.
There was actually a really great list that somebody tweeted, this huge thread about commonly overlooked world building things, and I know that they had sports and religion on there. I thought that was really good. I can't remember all of the things, but I think for me, for this question,
I was gonna say, actually, you know, the thread that you're mentioning, I'm pretty sure I have it pulled up on my screen right now because I remembered it and totally flagged it. It definitely mentioned sports. You know, I'll go through this list maybe at the end once everyone's had a chance to respond and see if there's anything we've missed. So why don't you go ahead and I can always come back to this list to flesh out, you know, whatever it is we might have missed.
Well, so when I was thinking about this question, really what came up for me was, as an editor, what are the common problems that I see? So it's not necessarily what's like the particular world building aspects that are overlooked, but the kind of skills that might be overlooked when trying to work it in. And we've already mentioned info dumping as a big no-no, and I see that a lot. Because it reads more like an encyclopedia and less like a character's authentic experience of their environment. And that's really what we're going for. We want to be in our character's skin, right? I've also seen scenes that are written for the purpose of world building that don't really have a clear connection to the plot. I would avoid that too. Find some way to either use that information in a scene that does connect directly to the plot, or to find a way to move the plot forward in that scene. And then inconsistencies in world building are things that stick out to me like a sore thumb. I can go into that later with a future question, but.
Yeah, certainly. And we'll, like you said, we'll hop into that right near the end of the conversation. And then Danielle, you know, you were the one that I believe brought up swearing as something that can be overlooked. What else would you have on your list of possibly overlooked items in world building?
Something I feel like gets overlooked quite a bit is actually counting and the way people count time. We very commonly think of hours and years, but that's so specific to us. And there's no reason that another planet with a completely different culture would use that. And so I always try, whenever I'm working on a new project in a new world, to think of something that actually fits what they would really use to measure. So in the case of my most recent project, as I said, it was in a Great River civilization, they use the yearly flood. Mm. And so they don't measure in terms of years, but they measure in terms of floods, how many floods you've seen. You know, little things like that can really help get a lot more flavor.
Yeah, certainly. And Sione, I saw that you had a point you'd like to make here.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. And this is only tangentially related, but yesterday I looked up what day it is in Ethiopia, because I knew that they used a different measurement of time than we do. And it's the year 2010 in Ethiopia. And they have 13 months instead of 12. And of course, the months have totally different names than what we're used to. But I didn't know that they counted the hours differently. Hmm. Like 9 in the morning for us is 3. It doesn't say 3 a.m., 3 p.m. It's just three. The number 3 for them. And I was just like, mind blown.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I'll hop in on this train too, talking about time, because Danielle, when you brought this up, I thought of, and I hope I'm remembering this correctly, but I believe it's in Patrick Rothfuss, in the Kingkiller Chronicles, we get these references to like these different days of the week, etc. And they're just kind of dropped in. There's no explanation. We don't get paragraphs of explanation for the calendar system or what have you. It's just, we get a feel for, well, that's just what this day is called. Over time, I think I kind of get the impression there's like 11 or 13 days in what we might call a week or something like that. You just get dropped very casually into the world. And I think that can be a really fun experience for readers. So always really good stuff to touch on there. And I'm actually going to pull up this list of commonly possibly overlooked things and see what else might come up. So here's some things on this massive Twitter list. And listeners, if you want to check this out for yourself, it was tweeted by Lindsay Beth on January 22nd. She tweets at L_M, but it's spelled E, LLLE_EM, as in mother, not M as in Mancy, Archer joke. But some of the things that she talks about on here are like salacious cultural gossip, you know, like who are the trendsetters in that culture, you know, like do they have like a Kardashians, so to speak, is something that I can think of off the top of my head. Holidays, that ties a little bit into the calendar system. You know, what are the major holidays they celebrate? Danielle, you mentioned, you know, everyone's judging their life in one of your works in progress by how many floods they've lived through. Well, what holidays, you know, might coincide with something like that? And, you know, does your main character even care about some of these things? Like, for example, plenty of us can walk through the world and not particularly care for a particular sport or sports in general or whatever gossip People Magazine is putting out there on the day-to-day. And I think if we can create a world of things that we as writers may not even totally be engaged with, but maybe our main character engages with some of them, not all of them, whatever it is, they might not match up with us, then we can really bring out some of these awesome details. So again, feel free to check out this massive list. It's quite the long tweet. It's got something like 16,000 favorites on Twitter, so you know it did well for itself. But yeah, that was Lindsay Beth, and that was January 22nd. All right. Well, we've talked a lot about things that can be overlooked, things that we should include, how we should drop it all in there. But, you know, that's all fine and good until we realize that we need a way to keep all of our world-building notes together. So let's get Chris involved in the conversation here again. Chris, what is it that you normally like to do to make sure that you're able to keep all of this together? I'm sure it's very difficult just to keep it in our head. So what's your strategy for making sure that we can keep it all organized?
I'm a heavy outliner before I write, so I make a lot of notes, but I'd like to mention something a famous fantasy writer implements. Writer's Victoria Schwab, and she believes world building, it needs to be specific, but at the same time, it's okay to be a little general because you don't want to limit yourself in a corner, if that makes sense. Like, you don't, like, if you have one thing, the reader can infer other things. Like if there's electricity, possibly the reader could infer there's cars and other types of technology too.
Yeah, it's sort of reaching into something that I talk about. I believe it is the first Biblio Breakdown episode, so that you can search for that one under the RightsCast list of episodes. And that's talking about sort of like reaching into the metasphere, which is like real world context that readers have, and using that to kind of shape the vision that a reader has for the world you've presented. I think that's a really good point. And then is there anything, Chris, that aside from, you know, making sure you have an outline in advance, is there anything that you do outside of the outline for your plot, for example, to help you keep some of those world building details organized?
A lot of it is I fix it, I reread it during the revising process, because it's okay for the first draft not to be perfect and there's an inconsistency. It just needs to be fixed before the final draft.
Yeah, there's certainly something to be said for, you know, quote unquote, letting it go in that first draft and letting yourself be curious, as Danielle mentioned earlier, you know, explore that world as much as possible. And so with that in mind, you know, let's hop over to Danielle. You know, what is it that you like to do to keep all of your world building notes in one place?
So I write what I would call my book Bible, and I've heard other authors use the term as well. I tend to keep it usually in Evernote. I find Evernote to be really simple for me to organize notebooks for each world I'm working with. And then within that, I can write almost encyclopedia-like entries on the different topics that I want information on. And I can easily organize it so that if I'm writing something and I realize, oh no, I need to know something about this religious festival that's happening that my characters have stumbled into, I can easily open up Evernote, go to the entry for that festival or that god or goddess or what have you, and get that information, and that way I'm always going to one place consistently to pull it. I do a little bit of work in spreadsheets too for things that don't translate as well into something like Evernote. I have done the Conlang thing, and for that it was a lot easier to keep a lot of that in a spreadsheet just so I could have like the translations there. But I highly recommend a program like Evernote.
You know, one thing I'm curious about with your approach, Danielle, because this is something that I'm starting to encounter as my world for empathy sort of like continues to balloon outward, is as you're writing, do you find yourself stopping, you know, the flow of your writing to make those quick references or glances to what you have in Evernote, or do you kind of plow through the scene and then make sure it's tidy later?
I actually write with Evernote open.
Okay.
So I am never not writing without Evernote on. And the nice thing, too, is I can access Evernote on my phone. So sometimes I'll open it on my phone instead of opening it in a window on my computer so that I can very easily check things on my phone as I'm going. For me, that's just how I work. I would rather make sure I got it right the first time than risk missing it later, because if it's not something that stands out as a huge inconsistency, it's not something anyone except me is going to be able to find. So I like to do it as I go. For me, that's not a huge distraction.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm just thinking about that for myself and kind of comparing that to what Chris suggested earlier. You know, I think at least when I'm writing, I do maybe something that's kind of in between. Sometimes I'm very much like, yes, I'm totally going to need to have my reference materials open. Other scenes I know maybe, I'm going to give a little shrug, use some of that hand waving, be a little general. Like Chris mentioned with that Victoria Schwab quote, you know, it's whatever works for you in the end. So, Sion, do you have any suggestions, recommendations? What is it that you like to use to keep world building details together? What would you recommend?
Well, in terms of the world building that involves the five senses, I have a tendency to really vividly envision my characters moving around in their settings. And mm-hmm. so I don't tend to need a lot of help with that stuff. But when it came to, for example, researching laws about marital rights in 1717 England, I write in Scrivener, and Scrivener has a research section in each file, and so I plop all that stuff there, and like it's similar to how Danielle uses Evernote, except it's just all in my Scrivener file.
And I'll add this in there as an alternative to either Evernote or using Scrivener. And I write in Scrivener. I'm not very good about throwing all of my research into the same document. I don't know why. I just totally defeat the purpose of that element of the program. But what I like to do is use Google Docs. They actually have some really nice organizational tools that you can use if you consider yourself, you know, semi-literate with putting links into the documents. You can find your way through the table of contents very smoothly, you know, and of course using that Control F feature to dig up whatever it is you need. It's kind of like, I don't know, that's what seems to work for me. So there's a few different ways to keep all of this together. And Siona, so you've got a point you'd like to make here.
Yeah, when you were saying that, it reminded me, I also get some, I mean, yes, it's about world building, it's more than that, but I get some inspiration from Pinterest. So I have a Pinterest account, and if I am needing some inspiration or sort of a visual reminder of the term that I'm trying to create, then I'll just go into there and look at pictures of hot guys mainly.
whatever works. I haven't used Pinterest because I don't have an account, but I've looked at other Pinterest boards and use that to get things like fashion correct, because I don't know much about fashion. And so I'll try to find like, all right, here's an aesthetic that I like, and what is this pinned under? How is it referred to? And that kind of helps kind of a backwards, you know, backing my way into it, so to speak.
Exactly. Yeah. I for one of my books, it was set in the near future, the next 50 years, and I did a lot of, I wasted a lot of hours on Pinterest looking at really awesome sort of post-apocalyptic Italian fashion and the tech that they might have and art and some artist visions for architecture and things like that.
Yeah, certainly. That sounds like a really, nice way to pass the time too, because again, we're letting ourselves be curious, which of course is a big theme that we're seeing come up here over the course of this podcast.
It's not procrastination if it's research.
Yep, that's right. That's good. I like that. That should be on a mug or something like that. Well, Chris, I know that you have talked about how you use an outline to kind of guide you through the process and maybe to store, you know, your world-building details. Would you say that that's also how you ensure that your world remains consistent as you go about writing, or do you have other strategies that you'd like to use to make sure that there's consistency on the page?
I feel like that's part of it, but another thing is, I feel like this goes back to the previous point of it's okay to be a little general. The reader doesn't have to know everything about the world in that particular scene or chapter. Like going back to the car and electricity example, this ties to my YA fantasy novel In the Name of Magic, which is forthcoming from Nine Star Press in June. I mentioned cars before electricity because the characters go in their cars at the end of the first chapter and into chapter two. And that was what was most organic to the story. And I think that also ties to how a lot of world building doesn't always make it onto the page, and that's okay, but it informs how you write the scene, chapter, or entire novel.
Yeah, certainly. And then, like, you know, you're saying there's something to be said for leaving it general once in a while and letting readers kind of fill in those details. And it's almost like a little bit of a hand wave to maybe prevent ourselves from making consistency mistakes because we're allowing the reader to fill in some of those details.
And I would say it's also important to each writer has to decide what's relevant to their story or novel, because what is relevant to my story or novel might not be relevant to another writer's story or novel.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think that transcends, you know, genre even. We're talking about, you know, with world building, I think there's often this idea that it's going to be very fantasy heavy. It's going to be very sci-fi heavy because we have to create, you know, we see a lot of creation of cultures from the ground up, but that's going to be true, of course, regardless of the genre we're writing in. It's all about where we want to point that. I've seen John Adamus, who's actually been a RightsCast guest as well. He talks about it as using that it's the camera that we give readers, you know, to guide them through the world. What is it that we're going to focus our camera on in any given moment? And what's appropriate for some genres may not be appropriate for others, may not be appropriate for certain scenes within the same manuscript, for example. And that all comes from that world building. Those details come from that. So let's hop over maybe to Danielle and talk about, you know, your strategies for remaining consistent as you go about writing. We've talked a little bit about Evernote. I know that you like to have it open as you write. Maybe then if you want to talk about your editing process, like how do you go back and make sure you pulled everything correctly out of Evernote?
Yeah, so when I'm editing a manuscript, because like you said, I use Evernote so consistently while I'm writing that I try not to have any major consistency issues, but sometimes things come up. You know, sometimes halfway through a book, you realize I need X thing. I need a new holiday. I need a new tradition. I need a marriage rite. You know, something that you didn't realize you needed at the outset. I have a personal rule where I try not to introduce something too close to the end of the book that's wholly new. Just from personal experience, sometimes that feels like a bit of a deus ex machina if you do that too close to the end. So if it's something that I think would be fairly important in the world, I'll then go back and try to foreshadow it a little bit earlier in the novel so that by the time we reach a point where it's relevant, it doesn't feel like it's coming completely out of the blue, that it's something that still fits. So little things like that are techniques I look for when I'm editing, just to make sure that everything feels smooth and there's nothing that really stands out as being too much.
Right. No, that's a really good point. It's actually something that I've never heard like stated out loud, but it makes perfect sense in that, yeah, you could throw something in at the last minute to have it be a cool idea, but if there's not that, if it hasn't sort of bled through the cracks throughout the manuscript, then it does feel like it's just being wedged in there. And that kind of, I don't know, it's like having a really nice tapestry that's done in these really cool colors, and then at the end you just throw in like some orange just for fun. I don't know, it's gonna stand out, everyone's gonna look at it. You had a really nice greens and blues going. I don't know, textiles, can't live with them, can't live without them. What am I talking about? All right, Sion, let's hop over to you. What is it that you do, or as an editor, when you're looking at consistency, what is it that you know, you really like to focus on in this regard?
Yeah, well, I think it's much easier for me to look at other people's work and notice inconsistencies than it is my own work. And I think that's because I have a really strong need for clarity, and I also have a good memory for details. And so if there are details that seem to contradict each other, that reads to me as unclear, and then I get my angry face on. Not really, but but yeah, that's why the inconsistencies tend to stick out at me when it's someone else's work that I'm editing. When it's my own work, though, I mean, you guys know how it is. Like, you were so in that space that you can't, you know, it's like everybody can see that it's a bad relationship except for the person who's in it, right? Because mm-hmm. they're too much in the weeds. It's like that. So the only thing that I really know of is get other people's eyes on it, and they'll see it and point it out, and you're like, oh crap, okay, I'll go fix it.
Right. Definitely. Sometimes the best way to know you've done it wrong is to have someone else tell you, because like you said, we can't always recognize that when we're so married to these worlds that we create. We were so curious, we loved them so much, we played around, and then maybe we changed some things along the way. So, well, very good. Let's take a moment then and maybe collect some final thoughts on world building. Any last advice? Chris, let's start with you. Is there anything that you'd like to leave listeners with where it comes to world building before we bring this session to a close?
I had another example of how using world building can do more than one thing at a time.
Sure.
I mentioned a magical duel thing being in lieu of a sporting event in my YA fantasy in the name of magic, but I also have a Christmas and Hanukkah-like holiday in my novel, and that was relevant because it wasn't just about a holiday, it was about what the holiday means to the characters, because a lot had changed over the last year, and it was a good way to really dive in and explore all the emotions.
Yeah, it kind of plays back into that whole positive feedback loop. And I think in that case, we have an example of world building, not just feeding character and plot, but it sounds like it might be feeding into something like theme then as well. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, and it was a way to complicate the novel without being overly complicated.
Yeah, certainly. It adds a nice fresh layer, but without having it be like that orange and our cool colored tapestry up to that point.
And it was still a way for readers to feel like the novel was accessible, because, you know, the holidays, regardless of what a person's religion is, a lot of people have a holiday at some point during the year and can identify, you know, like if someone passed away or something, this holiday is different because of that.
Yeah, it's about creating, I guess, greater, you know, relatability for a reader as well in those cases. You know, is there something that they can identify with in this fantasy world that will help pull them even more into the story beyond just the presentation of the characters themselves? Let's turn it over to Danielle. Any last thoughts from you on world building?
One thing I would say is, going back to the discussion we were having on info dumping, don't feel like you need to explain everything. Don't feel like you have to spell out exactly what everything is. A lot of times, simply repetition of terms will allow the reader to figure out from context clues what it is that you're talking about. And in fact, a lot of the most immersive books I've read were like that. It feels more natural. The characters aren't explaining things every 2 seconds, because in real life, we don't really do that. And, you know, your readers are pretty smart. Give them a little bit of credit and let them figure some of that out for themselves. You know, you have to be careful not to be confusing about it, but it is definitely doable and a very rewarding experience as a reader, too.
Yeah, certainly. I think those are all really good points and really great things for us to take with us as we move forward. Let's go to Sione then. Any final thoughts that you'd like to throw in on the topic of world building?
Yeah, quick aside, based like off of what Danielle just said, when I read the first Harry Potter book in Spanish, I'd never read it in English, and my Spanish was not that great, but eventually through reading, I figured out what words meant owl and broomstick because of the ways from the context clues, just like Danielle said. So yes, that works.
And I'll actually one second to jump in on that train, only because I have something to share that's like perfect for that too, is I actually read the entire Hunger Games series in Portuguese. And I had not read them in English, and it was the same thing. Like, I was trying really to immerse myself in it because it was my first time in Brazil, and I was like, well, everyone's talking about these books. I guess I'll pick them up. And it's amazing, like, how even as a non-native speaker who's just learning a language, like, context means so much, and that really just goes to show how important it is when we're writing, even for people who are reading in their native language.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about, like, Star Trek, I don't know what the hell a photon torpedo, like, I don't know how that works. I just know it's a weapon, and it's powerful, and there's, like, some flashy energy stuff around it, and that's really all I need to know, right?
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah.
I don't need to know the science. I don't need to know how the warp engine works. But anyway, yeah, so not to blah blah forever, but I just wanted to pull together a point that Chris made with my first point about, like, why for me everything comes from character, and really making sure to root the world building that you're doing in your character's experience of that world, and it's for that reason that each book that one writes, the world building that needs to be worked out is going to be slightly different because those characters are different.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. That's a very good point. Well, unless anyone has anything else to add, I will say thank you first to Sione for joining me again on this episode in the Novel Approaches series. So thank you, Sione.
Thank you.
And thank you, Danielle, for coming back to the Rights Cast. It's always a pleasure to have you here.
It's always a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
And Chris, thank you for joining us for this first ever episode, your first ever episode on this Rights Cast Network program. So we hope you'll come back some other time and discuss another topic with us.
Thank you. I had a lot of fun.
That'll wrap it up for this episode of Novel Approaches. Thanks to both of our guests, Danielle Maurer and Chris Bedell, for joining us for this episode. You can find Danielle on Twitter at RyeRaconteur and Chris at Chris Bedell. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love it if you could leave us a 5-star rating and a review on iTunes under the RightsCast Network name. Your rating will help other writers find the RightsCast Network and all of the programming we make available to the writing community, something we're grateful to be a part of. If you'd like more Novel Approaches episodes or want to check out any of the other awesome shows on the RightsCast Network, you can head to rightscast.net or find us on Twitter at RightsCast. Thanks to Sion for co-hosting with me, and thanks, of course, to you listeners for tuning in. We owe another thank you, of course, to Kristen Oakley, who's one of the RightsCast Network's patrons over at patreon.com/rightscast. As a donor of $3 per episode, her contributions to the network are a huge boon in helping us to become self-sustaining. Are you a RightsCast Network listener who's interested in becoming a supporting member of our programming in exchange for great patron rewards? You can learn more at patreon.com/rightscast and become a patron at even $1 or $2 per episode. Coming up on the next installment of Novel Approaches, Sion and I will be joined by guest John Adamus for a conversation on theme, so stay tuned for that episode's debut on June 15, 2018. If you have any feedback on the show or just have questions on world building, again, we're online at rightscast.net, or you can email us at rightscast@gmail.com. Our Twitter handle, one more time for you, is at RightsCast, and we Novel Approaches co-hosts tweet as IamRRCampbell and Write, Learn, Dream. Thanks as always for listening. Write on and write well.
This is the RightsCast Network at rightscast.net.